NPR.
From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me. Well, coming up tonight, how one man's journey through career shifts, burnout, and divorce helped him find new interpretations of what it means to be strong, resilient, and healthy as a man. Patricio Rubio speaks with entrepreneur Kevin Green in the second half of our show as we wrap up Men's Mental Health Awareness Month. Plus, many rural New York counties have no official homeless shelters and instead use hotels and motels as their primary emergency shelter. Increasingly, families are winding up in these temporary shelters for less than temporary spans of time. Investigative reporter Spencer Norris did a deep dive into this issue for ProPublica New York Focus. We have that story coming up in a minute. But first up, to get us started, some local news, because while some of us have to work most of this week, others are might already be in their Independence Day weekend or just hours away from it starting. Specifically, folks in Honesdale, they're just 51 hours away from seeing some fireworks. Folks in Honesdale, well, they're only 51 hours away from seeing some fireworks because Honesdale's fireworks celebration has been rescheduled to Wednesday, July 2nd, and this is due to weather, and yes, that is this coming Wednesday. The Greater Honesdale Partnership has rescheduled the annual Honesdale Fireworks Celebration to this Wednesday evening. The partnership checked with weather officials and their community partners and made this decision to ensure a safe and enjoyable evening because they have more than fireworks going on. Festivities began at 6:30 Wednesday evening in Central Park with live music presented by the Wayne County Creative Arts Council. The Doug Smith Band starts it off, followed by the Crystal Band at 8 p.m. And there'll also be food vendors and novelty stands as well. And the fireworks begin at dusk, which will be about 9 p.m. And the fireworks will be shot off from Irving Cliff. Folks have been invited to bring their families, friends, chairs, and blankets. Again, Honesdale's fireworks are now happening Wednesday evening. And there's more info at visithonesdalepa.com. Next up, we have the latest news for New York State, where folks will likely see their unemployment benefits rising. State officials are putting an extra $7 billion into the system. WNYC's Jimmy Vielkind reports.
The cap on unemployment benefits will rise by more than $350 a week. It's the first permanent increase since 2019. Governor Hochul says the old maximum benefit wasn't enough to cover rising costs of rent and groceries.
And when we can do something like this, it sends a message that we care so deeply about every stress that people are going through, especially the high cost of living.
Under the change, people out of work can receive up to $869 a week. State officials had to settle a debt the unemployment system racked up during the COVID-19 pandemic when thousands of people lost their jobs and the federal government supplemented benefits. The higher benefits will kick in starting in October. In Albany, I'm Jimmy Vielkind for the New York Public News Network.
Thank you, Jimmy. On to our next story. Many counties in upstate New York lack dedicated homeless facilities, and they're increasingly relying on hotels and motels to house the homeless and those who've faced emergencies. But these lodgings frequently lack proper service and oversight. For example, after a toddler died in a motel here in Liberty, New York, that was being used as housing, a grand jury report told Sullivan County at the beginning of last year that it should not use motels for this type of housing. Spencer Norris is an investigative reporter we've had here on the show before. His most recent article for ProPublica and New York Focus explores how hotels became New York's go-to fix for homelessness and what it means for both those being housed in them and the communities that they're part of. I spoke with Spencer earlier today.
This is an issue that involves hundreds of hotels across the state, outside of New York City, and covering over 10,000 people a year as of recent years. I don't think that this was a issue that many people kind of saw coming. What happened was over the past say, 5 to 6 years, the state has lost a number of emergency shelters. They shuttered, I think, well over 130 total and have not been able to replace all of them recently. And in order to kind of make up for the gap that emerged in terms of coverage for the homeless population, which was growing at the same time, they started relying increasingly on these commercial hotels. Now, some counties had already been using the hotels and motels for years, and that wasn't necessarily surprising. Like, the state has known about this for a while, but we're seeing an increasing reliance on the hotels and motels in a lot of areas that historically have had pretty decent infrastructure as far as homeless shelters. Areas like Binghamton and Albany, they're all increasingly relying on the hotels in order to shelter both individuals and families.
Is this just a lack of infrastructure, or are there other cost pressures, contracting issues? Like, what has led to this?
I think it's a couple of different things. It's a really complicated question with a lot of different factors. For example, I don't think it's any secret that we're in the middle of a very serious housing and rental crisis in the country. And New York has certainly been subject to a lot of upwards pressure on rent. So a lot of people were just kind of pushed into homelessness that historically might have been able to find cheaper housing. A lot of stable, otherwise stable families that work 9-to-5 jobs, have a couple of kids, and generally had their feet under them, just kind of had the rug pulled over the past few years. So you're seeing an increasing concentration of families with kids. And that's one thing that a lot of the experts I've spoken to over the past year were really surprised by, because we've always historically thought of homelessness as this thing that affects certain very vulnerable populations, people with mental health issues, people with a substance use disorder. And now all of a sudden it is starting to crush otherwise lower middle class families that don't have any of these vulnerabilities. So to get back to your question, an increase in rent is certainly one of the major issues. In addition to a lack of shelter space. And then one of the other big things that we really chose to highlight in our investigation was a lack of services for the people that are placed in the hotels. So if you're placed in one of the state's regulated shelters, they're required to provide certain services that are supposed to help you sort of get out of the situation, like meals, assistance finding housing, occasionally childcare. There's all these other factors that are supposed to ease the burden and make it easier for you to get back into permanent housing. But what we found is for the families that are in the hotels, they're not receiving these services generally because the hotels, they're not a shelter, right? They're not required to hire staff to provide all these additional services. So a lot of these families, in addition to being in an extraordinarily difficult position to begin with, aren't receiving all of these services that the state has said that they should be.
Your answer there kind of reveals that there's no way to really talk about why is this happening without also talking about what's pushing people to need homeless shelters. And then it comes back to what resources are being made available to those people in communities and that level of municipal response. So it's this double whammy of increased pressure on people and on families, and then also a lack of municipal support.
Certainly. I mean, to your point, everything that I just described, the state has oversight on, and they're supposed to make sure that the counties are providing such and such services to people. But when you zoom in, the thing is, it's the counties that are responsible for setting up homeless shelters. It's the counties that are responsible for where people are going to go and what services they're going to receive. That's the burden of the local social services departments. And I think what we've seen, both through this investigation and through previous reporting that my colleagues at New York Focus have done, a lot of these social service districts are in kind of a resource crunch. There historically were issues with being able to retain new caseworkers, and the state is trying to put out additional funding to help them get the people that they need to manage all these additional cases. But the reality is that they're just under-resourced in a lot of cases. and don't really know what to do with such an outsized population that's newly homeless.
And you mentioned, you know, some folks who are watching what's happening on the ground being surprised that there's more and more families involved. It also sounds like this was, a sort of ad hoc solution that didn't have families in mind. Is that part of what's going on here, too, that people just weren't conceiving of having to house entire families at a time?
Certainly. I think that is an issue historically. I mean, not just New York or the municipalities, this kind of way, the way the entire nation has thought about homelessness for a long time. Like I said, this was always something that we conceived of as an issue specifically with individuals that have all these additional vulnerabilities. I don't think the majority of people out there could have conceived that we were going to have an increasing number of mostly stable families with children landing in homelessness. And I think that's reflected in the way the shelter system was designed, which historically was aimed at housing individuals. I think that you're right. This is effectively an ad hoc solution that the state has known about and should be doing more to provide services to these families based on their own regulations. It's just they, at some level, did not predict that this was going to happen, but also maybe should have been keeping a closer eye on the situation in the first place.
Can you tell us a bit about what the conditions are like inside the shelters that are supposed to be temporary but often are not?
It varies. It depends on who the hotel operator is. We've encountered a lot of operators that we were told are doing their best to provide some measure of comfort for this population, and we're on top of, you know, housekeeping, on top of keeping their facilities in good repair. We also encountered a lot of places that aren't doing this. The very first day I started reporting the story, I went out to a motel that a source brought me to, and this woman allowed me into her room and showed me around, and she was taking a risk by doing that, by the way. She could have been sanctioned by social services for having a visitor. But me and a friend who was on the trip with me, we looked around, and the mattresses that she and her kids were sleeping on were covered in black mold. My buddy leaned against the wall at one point, and the paint started flaking off on his coat. It was a tiny room for four or five people. And just in kind of a decrepit state. There was wind coming in under the door, and this was January of last year, very cold winter. And I think that was kind of the moment when I realized, like, this needs to be my next investigation, because it was so immediately apparent to me that the conditions that some people are being placed in by social services districts are unconscionable.
What differences were you noticing in this practice of using hotels as shelters in rural areas versus more urban areas?
Great question. The benefit of some of the shelters, and I want to point out, I'm not arguing that homeless shelters are Shangri-La. They're not these incredible places in and of themselves. There are many issues netted with them, but the hotels introduce a series of different issues. And one of them, to your point, is where they're placed. Shelters historically are located relatively close to city centers or somewhere in the metropolitan area where it's supposed to make it easier for people to access the services that they need. And a lot of places will use hotels that are closer to urban centers, but the reality is a lot of these hotels, they are out in the sticks. They are off of any major transportation line. And if you wound up in this position the first place, it's a pretty good chance that you don't have transportation. You don't have your own car. So we ran into some other people while we were reporting the story that were half an hour to a 45-minute walk to the nearest grocery store. Their social service department was two towns over, wasn't even in the same county in some cases. So you wind up with a lot of cases where people are not just without the services that they need, but they can't even get themselves to the places that, in some cases, they're required to go in order to maintain their benefits. If you have to go back to the social service offices once a week, once every other week, and you don't have a car and there's no bus running to your town, you're in some kind of trouble. It's going to make it significantly harder to get out of this kind of position.
Yeah, I mentioned in the intro that, you know, following a tragic death of a 16-month-old a couple of years ago at Knights Inn Motel in Liberty, the Sullivan County Grand Jury released a 100-page report that included, among other recommendations, to rethink the use of motels to house vulnerable populations. And the grand jury said, quote, "The amenities provided are insufficient to meet the needs of those most likely to face instability, particularly those with substance use disorders, bringing home a newborn child," end quote there. So that was something, and that was that report came out very early in 2024. This article that I'm quoting from is from January 9th of 2024. There's an official response and something that's like actually in writing from a grand jury saying, maybe don't do this. And I'm curious, as you investigated this, as you reported this, are you seeing shifting perceptions? Are you seeing any other public markers, you know, such as what the grand jury said or other people just working on policy solutions?
Certainly. Well, I think that it is no mystery to the state that this is a less than optimal solution. In the course of our reporting, we learned that the state, particularly the Office of Temporary and Disability Assistance, which is the agency responsible for overseeing homeless services statewide, they were specifically warned by the state comptroller, look, there are issues on these hotels. And in the response, OTDA said, yeah, I mean, we're struggling with the fact that we can't get on-site services here. Is going to lead to additional complications. I don't think it's any mystery to anybody that's paying attention to this issue right now that the hotels are not an optimal outcome and that a lot of people that are placed there are struggling. In terms of what the solution actually is, I mean, it's almost kind of trite, but the answer could very well be just don't allow people to fall into homelessness in the first place. There are additional funding streams that the state can certainly beef up on that would prevent people from losing their housing to begin with or would be able to subsidize them when they're trying to get into a new place. And really, that was one of the things that just shocked me throughout this reporting process is how expensive homelessness is. It's almost a contradiction, right? We're dealing with a population that has been economically decimated in the vast majority of cases. And yet we're spending thousands or collectively over $100 million a year to place them in the hotels and motels. While we were reporting this story, we focused on one family in particular. And I highly recommend you go check out the story at ProPublica.org as well as New York Focus, NYSFocus.com. But while we were reporting the story, we followed this family and when we ran the numbers, we realized that the state spent more to place them in a series of hotels throughout Broome County than it would have cost to just pay their back rent and prevent them from losing their housing in the first place. So that is kind of the conundrum in all of this. Why aren't we just doing more to prevent people from falling into homelessness in the first place?
We've been talking to Spencer Norris. Spencer, I want to thank you so much for this reporting. As you said, is up now at ProPublica.org as well as NYSFocus.com. Spencer, thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Jason. Really appreciate the time, man.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
It is The Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole. June is Men's Mental Health Awareness Month, and right now, Radio Catskill's Patricio Robayo has a story that shines a light on men's health and well-being. Patricio spoke to keynote speaker and entrepreneur Kevin Green from Division I Athletics to Fine Dining and an appearance on the Food Network's Chopped. Green's journey is one of resilience and reinvention, but also one of career shifts, burnout, and divorce. He talks about redefining what strength can mean for men.
Throughout my professional journey, there's been seasons of time where I felt burned out or like there was a lot. I know when I was a public educator, it's a situation where you're asked to spin a lot of plates, get compensated for a few of those, and just feel like there's not enough time in the day. And so that's shown up here and there. But, I've just decided to pivot a lot. So I've got a lot of stories about that.
Yeah. So let's talk about, can you share some of your views on emotional vulnerability? The norms are, it's tough for men to sort of express themselves because it's hard to be vulnerable as a man sometimes.
Yeah. So we alluded to divorce even. And so I've had a variety of pivots professionally and personally. And I went through some things where I was not great at communicating and I suffered in silence and I didn't really know what to do. And I've sought therapy and counseling over the years for different things, but now I was fortunate to have some guys at the gym where we could talk a little bit. And I think a lot of men are conditioned to suffer in silence and they don't know what to do about what's going on internally. And so, I'm here to say that there's a way to get help. There's a way to seek help and we can find resolution.
But why do you think men still struggle to talk openly about mental health? You mentioned that, you found these group of guys at the gym, but it's not a common thing that amongst folks, even friends, close friends, to talk about, what they struggle with when it comes to mental health.
Well, I think for a lot of us, we're grown up in at least a generation where men are supposed to be tough and have it all figured out. And, as a speaker, one of the things people fear the most about speaking is being seen, being vulnerable. It's that expression and likeliness that you'll be judged. And so as men, I don't want to be seen as insufficient or not enough. And so it's easier to be quiet, not say anything and just deal with it. And so we need to encourage men to speak up, share their thoughts, find help, et cetera. There's no shame in that. And I think actually it's one of the greatest forms of strength being expressed is to be vulnerable and be able to articulate what's going on.
Yeah. And for yourself, what were some of the warning signs of burnout in your own life? And how did you initially respond to it?
Yeah. So this is in 2023. It was one of the most challenging years of my life. I thought I was going to scale my personal chef business. I met a guy. We were talking about being partners and scaling something. I was also going through divorce. And it was just, I was at a professional conference in the fall. I was literally sitting in a seat at a conference, dealing with this jerk of a potential partner, trying to get me to do things that were outside of my expertise that I didn't own up to, all the while dealing with a phone call with a lawyer on lunch break. And I was like, what in the world is happening right now? And so I still showed up. I still attended and got value in the conference. But when all that smoke cleared, I had to take the first few months of 2024 and was like, you know what? I can't force issue. I can't worry about bills being paid. I'm going to build some margin and just ease into this, rest, reset, and press on the gas in 6 months. And that's exactly what I had to do.
Yeah, which is tough. You're dealing with so much as a man, you're dealing with going through a divorce, launching a career, things like that. How do you pursue, success without compromising their mental health? How can men do this while compromising their mental health and their emotional well-being?
Yeah, so I've had a bent towards OCD or compulsive brainwiring since I was little. And so it's one of those things that I even tried medicine for, but it's just managed to understand it now, understand the design and how it works as it relates to perfectionism, uncertainty, the need for control. But I look at it like this. If there was a fence, if life was a fence and there was fear on one side and faith on the other, generally speaking, there's questions on both sides. So it's just this daily choice or momentary choice of which uncertainty do I want to live with and which one serves me the best? And I think we all know that the positive side is the one that pushes you forward. And so we have to live with that uncertainty and with that trust factor in order to have a high level of mental health.
You mentioned about, going through these transitions. I can't even imagine sitting at a conference and, going through a divorce and going getting those calls in the middle of it and trying to, try to get some value out of what you're attending. So what helps you navigate these transitions between, a divorce and career shifts? Those are two large family, large life events.
Yeah, it's tough. I am an active person. I race in these things called High Rocks. It's a hybrid fitness competition. I've always been a runner. I ran a distance in college. And so we have to have some outlet that's healthy. And so fortunately, I didn't ever turn to the pill or the drink for that or whatever, but I've always found an outlet in fitness. And so for me, that keeps me in check I say that running's the one thing that never betrayed, never lied, never cheated, never stole. And so for a lot of us, fitness can be that outlet. It keeps me sharp, keeps me sane. And outside of that, like I believe that there's a space for journaling and like some brain priming activities that we can do to kind of rewire our brain, to get us aligned, to get us focused and more productive and at peace.
Yeah, since you run so much and it's so much part of your life, if you ever miss a day or if you miss a session, does it feel off? Your whole day feels off a little bit?
Yes, it's kind of like brushing your teeth. Once you do a certain thing long enough, it becomes part of who you are and your routine. So I get kind of cranky if I go 1 or 2 days in a row without being active. But that's just how I'm wired. That's something I like about myself. Some people don't understand that. But yeah, so I like to be consistent in that. I think it's important to have going for me.
Yeah. And so you gave some advice already, but you want to go a little further here. And what advice would you give to other men, you know, facing major challenges, you know, either a job transition, you know, going to a divorce, going to a separation, losing their family, your whole life could sort of restart at different stages of your life.
So the phrase Southern grit and second chances really rings home. My story is not textbook. It's not a textbook at all, but it's one of those where I learned to hold things loosely, but also know that resilience is key and critical, and I've got to rise again. So I've literally left 2 jobs, 2 careers to start again because I was sitting at a table that no longer served me. I left corporate to start a business. I stepped away from the business to start a culinary program, and then I realized that was a box that was too small for me because I had more to offer and more to do. And I rebuilt again. And then post-divorce, I was like, you know what? This isn't what I wanted. This isn't the way I thought it was going to go. And so the cool thing is, and now that I'm speaking and doing things in that space, like had those things not have happened, I wouldn't be here. So everything happens for you and not to you.
Now you have an Instagram, you have social media. Do you want to talk about that a little bit? Has that sort of empowered your new movement in life?
Oh, absolutely. This is an interesting question. So for me, over the last 10 years, like social media was always kind of a side thing. I really never put a lot into it. I didn't really ever feel the need, but now it's so key and critical again that the last 8 months, I finally said, okay, now's the time. And a lot of that was because I hesitated because I didn't want to show up and be cliche or whatever. I wanted to have something authentic. And so now with Kevin Green Elevates, my speaking platform, I want to encourage and inspire and equip people to elevate every day, get better, particularly young professionals, college students, et cetera. And so now like I'm sharing what's in me. I'm releasing my voice. I'm kind of coming out of the closet a little bit because I was quiet for a long time. But now I have something to say and there's people that need to hear it.
Yeah. So how can folks find you on the interwebs and then the social medias? Where can they find you?
Yeah. So on interwebs and social media. So, Instagram's @ChefKevinCulinary. I'm on LinkedIn. It's Kevin Green, Kevin Green Elevates, same as TikTok. And then, internet is KevinGreenElevates.com.
Right. That's awesome. Well, Kevin, thank you so much for speaking to us. Is there anything I have not touched on you want, folks to know about you or just say anything like, you know, things, any last words about, you know, men's mental health during this month of mental health awareness month in June?
Yeah, I'll just say, Ad, lastly, you know, I went on, you mentioned Food Network's Chopped. I went on there. And if you have to go on national TV to kind of figure out yourself, why not? But that was a defining season. So you have to have a sense of yourself and who you are before you can figure out what to do. Identity comes before activity, and then you express. And so have a little signature swag. Be bold about it. Find out who you are. Be confident. If I can help in any way, let me know.
Kevin, thank you so much for doing this. I do really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Appreciate it.
All right.
Thank you, Patricio. Well, that's it for the local edition. I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me. Before we go, like we say, we're basically counting down to a big holiday weekend this weekend. We are also counting down to the start of our summer fun drive. There's a lot happening this weekend. We'll be kicking off our summer fun drive and be looking for your support at a time where you might have heard me mention this on air before, but we are increasingly under threat. Our funding here in public media is increasingly under threat. So we've been advising you to go to protectmypublicmedia.org, and I still advise that, and I advise you sharing that link with others as well, protectmypublicmedia.org. As we keep an eye on Washington, D.C. and try to figure out what is going to happen, one thing that we know for sure, whatever happens, we're still going to need your help, and we need it now more than ever. So as you get ready for your holiday weekend, remember, we're getting ready for this summer fun drive, and you can help us out with that right now by going to WJFFradio.org and giving what you can and spreading that link with your friends and neighbors as well. That's WJFFradio.org. Coming up, we've got Laura Flanders and Friends, Sabrina Artel's Trailer Talk, but first we have more news from The Daily. This is Radio Catskill.